wash your hands with it. Baby, hurry up and wash your hands with it. I'ma need you to wash your hands, darling. Hurry up and the sickness she's calling.
WBAI New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Thank you very much for tuning in. Thank you so much, King Downing, for Good Morning Nueva York. And it's 7 o'clock here in New York City, over listener-supported. That's listener-supported, commercial-free community radio, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. Coming up next, It's a Good Day with Johanna Fernandez.
Listening to non-corporate, listener-funded, community-controlled WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM, streaming globally at WBAI.org. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of It's a Good Day. Today, we welcome back to the show Chris Smalls, the fired Amazon worker of a long time ago, it seems, fired in April for organizing a demonstration against Amazon and its horrific COVID-19 safety policies. We'll talk to Chris about the BLM demonstrations he's been organizing in Hackensack, New Jersey for this Sunday. We'll also speak to members of a coalition in Flushing who organized a counter-protest to right-wing police march in their neighborhood. Stay tuned for headlines and the weather. Good morning, and here's your COVID-19 update. There are over 12 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 across the globe, and over 550,000 people have died from the virus so far. The COVID-19 crisis is deepening in the United States. The U.S. has surpassed the 3 million mark in COVID-19 cases. And as of this Tuesday, more than 60,000 new cases of COVID-19 have been reported in the U.S. every day. This, according to the data provided by the Center for Systems Science and Engineering at Johns Hopkins University. COVID-19 cases have been increasing in 80% of U.S. states. Among the epicenters of the pandemic are Florida, Arizona, and Texas. As of 11 a.m. yesterday, Florida had 41 hospitals with no available beds. Only 15% of Florida's adult ICU beds remain available, according to the state's Agency for Healthcare Administration. Since yesterday, Florida reports nearly 10,000 more cases, bringing the state to a total of over 224,000 diagnosed cases of the coronavirus. And in the last week, Florida has reported 261 new cases per 100,000 people, nearly three times the national average. And Arizona reported more than three times the national average cases, more than three times the national average case rate, that is, in the past week. According to Johns Hopkins University, one in four COVID-19 tests in Arizona is coming back positive, the highest percentage in the country. And an indicator that there are not enough testing kits available to keep up with the new coronavirus spread in that state of Arizona. On Tuesday, Texas reported more than 10,000 new COVID-19 cases, marking the highest single-day increase in new cases and deaths since the pandemic began. This, according to the Houston Chronicle's data team. From Monday to Tuesday, the statewide total had risen by 10,414 cases, or 5%, to a total of 216,000 cases, upwards of 216,000 cases. A record 75 deaths were reported over that one-day period. All of this in Texas. And the statewide death count in that state is now at 2,758. And the COVID-19 crisis in prisons and jails continues. The Federal Bureau of Prisons has said that there have been 94 prisoners who've died from COVID-19 at the Bureau of Prisons facilities. More than 5,000 federal prisoners have tested positive, although prisoner advocates have cautioned that the true rates of COVID-19 infection may be much higher than reported due to inconsistent testing availability in prisons. And Ohio leads states with the most deaths of prisoners due to COVID-19, with 86 reported through the end of June, 86 deaths in Ohio. And California's San Quentin prison is dealing with the third largest coronavirus outbreak in the United States. Since the first cases of COVID-19 were reported at San Quentin 5 weeks ago, more than one-third of the prisoners and staff, 1,600 people, have tested positive. Six have died. Researchers in the Bay Area say it didn't have to be this way. For the past 4 months, they have been offering prison officials free tests for the coronavirus, guidelines for protecting prisons from the pandemic, and increasingly frantic warnings that trouble was coming. It is feared that other institutions are at risk as well. One core recommendation has been for Governor Newsom of California, as well as governors in other states, to use their power to decarcerate, to bring people home because of the impossibility of social distancing and other health precautions in prison. Experts have also called for frequent testing of staff and any prisoners who are not released. Law firms filed motions in federal court requesting that California Governor Gavin Newsom compel California's prisons to heed expert advice. The court denied the motions, and correctional facilities have failed to fully implement the recommended measures. Here is Jose Saldana, Director of Release Aging People in Prison, on the need for decarceration amid the pandemic. He focuses on New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's failure to decarcerate. But as we have reported, governors around the country are falling far short in their responsibility to keep all their constituents safe by releasing prisoners. Let's take a listen.
Well, aging people in prison, those 50 and over, experience a health crisis just about every day of their lives for years and decades. Substandard health care is definitely taking its tolls in New York State prisons. Now comes this deadly virus to infect people who are most vulnerable, in not only in prison, but in our society. For Governor Cuomo not to address this particular issue, where the health conditions are just horrendous for the most part, and now with this deadly virus that's going to have catastrophic consequences, we have to look at this from a humanistic lens. All the health experts agree that in a prison setting that is breeding grounds for this virus, decarceration is the only solution to stopping the spread of this virus, and he has yet to listen to the experts.
And that is the terrible situation across the country. It appears that the unions of prison guards have been lobbying governors to not carry out the decarceration policies that they've outlined. And as there's a crisis of epic proportion in these prisons, Mumia Abu Jamal called from prison to a rally in Philadelphia last Saturday. Let's take a listen.
Remembering struggle, continuing struggle, and understanding that, like our ancestor Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand. Gotta make the demand. I just called to let you know I love you all.
We love you!
And I feel it. I feel it. I thank you all. I think of you all, and I will be with you all.
Let's go!
So, y'all keep doing what you're doing. I'll keep doing what I'm doing.
Right on, right on.
True.
And we will meet in the whirlwind.
Right on!
Special time, a time like someone my age hasn't seen in many years, but it's a time that's finally here.
Yes, sir.
And that means it's the right time. So, keep on revoluting, keep on resisting, keep on moving, stay on the move. I love you all. On the move.
And in the midst of this national crisis of COVID-19 in prisons and jails, once again, that was Mumia Abu Jamal, the legendary journalist and former Black Panther, who called in from prison to a rally last Saturday in Philadelphia. And the last bit of news before we go to our guest this morning is that the City University of New York has fired 2,800 employees, representing around 20% of CUNY's adjunct workforce. And now the union that represents CUNY faculty, the Professional Staff Congress, and that union, of which I'm a part, represents nearly 30,000 members of the university instructional and professional staff. That union has filed a lawsuit against the City University of New York with the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York. In its suit, the union alleges that in laying off thousands of adjunct faculty and staff, the university violated its obligation under the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, which we know as CARES. The university laid off staff within weeks of being awarded $251 million in relief money. When receiving funding from the CARES Act, CUNY was required, to the greatest extent possible, to pay its employees during the period of any disruptions or closures related to the coronavirus pandemic. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of It's a Good Day, and you're listening to Non-Corporate, listener-funded, community-controlled WBAI New York at 99.5 FM, streaming globally at WBAI.org. And we are happy to welcome today to the show, once again, Chris Smalls. He's our first guest today. And not long ago, he was a featured speaker at an online teach-in on political prisoners and U.S. empire organized in celebration of Mumia Abu-Jamal's birthday. As you might recall, in March, Amazon workers demanding safer work conditions in a Staten Island warehouse chanted, "How many cases we got? 10. Led by activist Chris Smalls, who was also a worker at Amazon since 2015, protesters held signs reading, "Money come and go, but health is irreplaceable." Money has definitely come. Amazon's CEO, Jeff Bezos, accrued $50 billion since the start of this pandemic alone, while the health of workers at Amazon has been treated as anything but irreplaceable. When we last had Chris on our show, it was the beginning of spring, and the United States had just surpassed 100,000 COVID-19 cases nationwide. We are now in the midst of a red hot summer and approaching 100,000 new cases each day. Chris's voice is as dire now as it was then. Since he was fired for leading a walkout of Amazon workers, Chris has founded an organization called the Congress of Essential Workers. And he's come today to tell us about his work and that his work is far from over. Chris Smalls, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Johanna. Good morning.
And I'm sure that our listening audience is ecstatic that you are back here with us.
Likewise. I'm happy to be here.
So tell us about the Congress of Essential Workers. What is it? And when did it begin to exist as an organization?
Absolutely. So yes, the Congress of Essential Workers is an organization that I created. You could kind of say the last time we spoke about midway April, right before our May 1st efforts. That was our first demonstration as a collective. During that demonstration on May 1st, International Workers' Day, we held a nationwide protest for the first time, and we included other entities, other major corporations like FedEx, Target, Instacart, Walmart, Whole Foods, and Amazon employees to participate in the nationwide walkout, call out, and sick out. And during that time, we were able to be successful in getting a VP of Amazon, Tim Bray, to resign on that day. So that was our first demonstration as a collective and as an organization. And I just tell you a little bit about our mission. Our mission here is to implement a rank-and-file democracy on the behalf of the workers of Amazon and beyond, for essential workers all across the nation to have a rank-and-file committee where they are able to control their own destinations and career paths with their companies, negotiate contracts for better pay wages, for Medicare, for child care, for the PPE that they deserve. So that's our mission. Our vision is to make sure that we take care of all essential workers, not only here in the States, but all across the globe. And that's what I'm doing every single day out here fighting.
Okay, this is fascinating to hear because we did report consistently on all of the workers' actions that were happening in the lead up to May 1st, and that was a pretty phenomenal showing of workers' power on May 1st with actions happening across the country. So you Absolutely. Mean to tell me that you were behind those efforts?
I sure was. I
through the Congress of Essential Workers?
Through the Congress of Essential Workers. We pretty much held conference calls every week leading up to May 1st. I orchestrated it. I spoke to many organizers across the nation. And on that day, we released a press release with all the parties that were involved. And my organization, the TCOEW, the Congress of Essential Workers, was definitely the catalyst of the nationwide protests that were happening on May 1st. As far as essential workers and these major corporations, as I listed, you know, Target, Instacart, Walmart, FedEx, Amazon, Whole Foods, we were the catalyst that actually orchestrated that. And it was very successful. And I'm proud to say that we actually pulled that off, and we're not done. We're just getting started.
And if folks who are listening in would like to support your efforts, where could they find you?
Absolutely. The same social media handles I have. I have Twitter, shut_down on Amazon. You can reach me on there. There you'll find my email, direct email where you can email me. There's a GoFundMe page up that I still use to collect money for the workers that have been out of work, that have lost their job. I paid out over $35,000 to employees and former employees of Amazon all over the world, actually, since my firing. So my firing gave me a platform to use and lift the voices that are unheard, and I've been doing that ever since. And I also have a petition out there on behalf of TCOEW to make that $2 pay that the company took away from them permanent. You know, I feel like that shouldn't have been the probe for employees to come to work. Since then, we had a number of people that have died that should have been prevented, and they're taking away things from these employees. So my organization is fighting for all of that. We want permanent hero pay. We want better pay wages, and we want to make sure that our employees, not just for Amazon, but all essential workers, are ultimately taken care of by these corporations.
And if you didn't get any of those particulars, you can email me to get in touch with Chris Smalls to donate or support his efforts in any way. My email address is Johanna, J-O-H-A-N as in Nancy, N as in Nancy, A at WBAI.org. And I'm going to remind our listening audience that when Chris Smalls was fired by Amazon, Amazon's general counsel, David Zapolowski, launched a smear campaign that used racially coded language to undermine Smalls' leadership and to suggest that he was incapable. And I mean, clearly that was a challenge to you to prove them otherwise. And of course, I remember that I asked you questions about how you organized the workers at Amazon to go out on that day in protest of the lack of PPE and safety precautions. And you went through it. You did a phenomenally just detail-oriented job. You went through all of the channels. You thought that you were going to get a response from the company, and you didn't. And after having gone through all the channels, you decided to park yourself, I remember, at the lunch counter where Amazon workers eat, and you started recruiting them there and raising awareness about the crisis before them. Amazing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Incredible. But you are here this morning to tell us about an action you're organizing this Sunday. Tell us about it.
Sure, absolutely. So we all know it's been over 120, 125 plus days. There's been no arrest for the killers of Breonna Taylor. And actually, you know, it's to be honest with you, it's been hard to see that this cause to raise justice for her was kind of, you know, kind of drowning out in the media with other things that's going on in this country. You know, we have the election and we have, you know, our well, not my president, but the president of the country that's, you know, stealing headlines and trying to distract us from the issues that's going on in this country. And this Sunday, my organization will be raising or continue to raise awareness for justice for Breonna Taylor. And my hometown, which I haven't been back since I graduated high school in 2007, this is very sentimental for me to bring some action to my hometown of Hackensack, New Jersey. This Sunday at 12 p.m. in Pasheeni Park, we will be having a rally to raise awareness and educate people on how to take action to for Breonna Taylor and her family. We demand that the officers be arrested immediately, not only arrested, fired immediately, arrested and prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. And we also want to educate people on how to dismantle the system that built a no-knock warrant for her to be murdered so that this never happens again. So this Sunday, we're rallying up in Hackensack, New Jersey. Anybody in the tri-state area that's listening today, I encourage you to come out and support us. We're asking for donations to help put this thing together for the artists. We're going to have some artists. We're going to have some spoken word. We're going to have some singers. We're going to have a peaceful protest. And we're going to have a peaceful march. And we want everybody that's for the cause and standing in solidarity with the Black community to come out and support us on that day. And Joanna, you're one of them. So I'm greatly honored and appreciative that you are joining us as a featured speaker on that day.
And I'm honored to join you and to join our brothers and sisters and non-gendered folk in New Jersey, Hackensack, New Jersey, this Saturday at 12 noon. Can you tell us once again the address? Because we have a listening audience in New Jersey, and we'd like them to join us if they can.
Absolutely. So once again, it's going to be 12 p.m. in Hackensack, New Jersey. I do not have the exact address for Pasheeni Park, but for our listeners, if you Google Pasheeni Park, it's the largest park in the town. Can't miss it. The first thing you see when you come into our town, it's one of the hugest parks, and it has about three baseball fields. And the closest landmark is Boulder City. It's a bowling alley, which is right adjacent from the park where we will be rallying. So once again, that is 12 p.m. Sunday, this Sunday, July 12th, 12 p.m. noon at Pasheeni Park in Hackensack. And I'll spell that out for our listeners. Pasheeni, F-O-S-H-I-N-I, Pasheeni Park in Hackensack, New Jersey.
And I've looked it up. I've looked it up, and it's 278 River Street in Hackensack, New Jersey. 278 River Street in Hackensack, New Jersey, Pasheeni Park, F-O-S-C-H-I-N-I. We're going to support this protest. It's probably one of the few protests that is organized specifically around the killing of Breonna Taylor.
Absolutely. I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Now, before you go, can you tell us how your life has changed since you were fired from Amazon?
Oh, wow. I'm still trying to get a grasp of that. You know, it's every day is it's different for me. But I wake up motivated every single day to do something. And, you know, before I even tell you, I just want to say to everybody that, you know, this time, these times that we're going through, you know, with the whole virus and the pandemic that we're dealing with, that started over 400 years ago, talking about, you know, racism and the slavery that we're still dealing with, the new day slavery. It's been tough, and I want to look back on this time, you know, once it's all said and done, and I want to say that I took action and I did something for a change, for my children. And, every day when I get up, you know, now, after I was fired, I said, what can I do? And, what have I done since then is, I actually been taking action. I've been on the picket lines, not only for the workforce of Amazon, but for the MTA workers, the bus transit drivers, the train operators, the unions for them, the local Fight Back 100s. And I've been on the picket lines with the nurses, New York Nurses Association, NYSNA. I've been at Governor Cuomo's office, on the picket lines. I've been at, Rikers Island, you know, I've been on the picket lines with the nurses for all the hospitals of New York, the nurses that have been advocating for their PPE and their protection. And I also have flown across the country. I traveled down to Atlanta. I traveled to California where I was protesting with Black Lives Matter. When the killing of George Floyd happened, and then Breonna Taylor, and all of them, Ahmaud Arbery, I've been with Mike Brown Sr. So I've been just on the ground taking action. I've been at Occupy City Hall. You know, I was over there a couple of nights. I've done, you name it, I try to get involved, and I try to use my platform to fight with everybody. And it's been a journey. It's been amazing. I've been learning and educating myself and meeting great people. I had the honor, not just once, but twice to be alongside Angela Davis and Danny Glover and some of the original Black Panthers like Arthur Lee. And also just for what you've done for me as well, Joanna, you actually was the one who included me for the celebration of Mumia. So that was a historical by itself, and I'm honored to just be a part of history, because this is what this time is. It's history in the making, and for everybody that's listening, like I said, you want to be on the right side of history, so I advise you to get out there and take action.
I'm Johanna Fernandez, and I'm speaking with Chris Smalls, the worker who was fired from Amazon, who has been on picket lines, protesting and defending the rights of workers. He is founder of the Congress of Essential Workers, and he is organizing a protest this Sunday, July 12th, at 12 p.m., at 12 noon, at Foschini Park, 278 River Street in Hackensack, New Jersey. Join us there. I will be there. Please join us. Thank you so very much, Chris, for amplifying the voices of the people who produce the goods, services, and profits of capitalism, workers. Thank you so much for revitalizing the struggle of workers in this country. And Absolutely. We look forward to our continued conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I appreciate this. And take care and be safe. We'll talk soon. See you soon.
See you soon. See you on Sunday.
Absolutely.
You're listening to non-corporate, listener-funded, community-controlled WBAI New York at 99.5 FM, streaming globally at WBAI.org.
Tengo grande la nariz porque yo soy negro, la sonrisa blanca y los labios gruesos. brazos me gusta trenzarme como mis ancestros y de pelo quieto, así es que soy yo. Me gustan las mujeres negras, blancas, indias, también trigueñas, porque todas son lindas, todas son bellas. Me gustan las mujeres negras, blancas, indias, también trigueñas, porque todas son lindas, todas son bellas. Negro, porque África me dio esa bendición, y blanco por consecuencia de la colonización. Soy seguidor de Mandela, Malcolm, Lincoln, Luther King, y el sabor de mis ancestros era muy carabalí. Me gustan las mujeres negras, blancas, indias, también trigueñas, porque todas son lindas, todas son bellas. Me gustan las mujeres negras, blancas, indias, también trigueñas, porque todas son lindas, todas son bellas. No elegí ser negro, tuve suerte, sangre africana por las venas, somos fuertes. Somos humanos, no me miras diferente. La vida sigue, así que mira para el frente. No te detengas, no analices mi color, pues tu ignorancia no define lo que soy. Me gritaron negro por ofensa a mi color, que lo grité más duro, con orgullo negro soy. Me gustan las mujeres negras, blancas, indias, también trigueñas, porque todas son lindas, todas son bellas. Me gustan las mujeres negras, blancas, indias, también trigueñas, porque todas son lindas, todas son bellas. Me gustan las mujeres negras, blancas, indias, también trigueñas, porque todas son lindas, todas son bellas.
Fuimos.
And my brother, Osvaldo Fernandez, sent me this song over the weekend. It's from Colombia, and it's Alex Quinn featuring Adrian Villafara with Tronic Beats, and it's called Negrito. And now we turn to Flushing, Queens, where last week Chinese Americans organized a pro-NYPD march in the context of a national uprising against police terror and calls to defund the police. They were met by Red Canary Song, a grassroots collective of sex workers and allies organizing for sex work decriminalization and migrant justice. The counter-protest organizers expected the turnout to be maybe 20 or 30 people, and the community came out to well over 100 people who joined this counter demonstration against a pro-cop rally. For many, it was a confusing sight. It was conservative Asian Americans against progressive Asian Americans duking it out at the Juniper Valley Park. Quote, confront agitators with compassion is one of the words, that was one of the messages of the protesters. This was, after all, their community, their neighbor, their families were among those protesting. What they were marching against was the police, not the people in the community. We love you, we don't love cops, they chanted. Here today to talk about their Flushing counter-protest and the fissures in Chinese-American politics, we welcome Lizzie Oh, And perhaps we have Essex Noir with us now and Kate Zen. Lizzie O works in the immigrant unit at Legal Aid Society and is a member of Queens DSA, Democratic Socialist of America. Essex Noir is a self-proclaimed thought leader, leading the conversation on the intersection of sex work and technology. She is co-president of Women of Sex Technology. We also welcome Kate Zen, an immigrant labor organizer and co-founder of Red Canary Song. Lizzie, Essex, and Kate, are you all there?
Yes, yeah, thank you, Joanna. Hi.
Hi there. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you so much for having us.
We're excited because we don't often hear about these protests. And so let's start with Kate. Kate, can you talk to us about the protests in Flushing in support of the police?
So this kind of conservative right-wing movement in the Chinese community has actually been going on for a long time and really strengthened under the Trump administration. I want to emphasize that this counter-protest wasn't just organized by Red Canary Song. We are one among a group of other organizations that came together, including several orgs that are involved with fighting the luxury development and gentrification in Flushing, as well as Chinese feminist and Asian American feminist groups and Asian anti-imperialist groups. So we have a coalition of people who really came out, as well as like Black and Latino allies. And speaking about, you know, this moment right now, I think the Chinese community has been really inundated with right-wing media inside of the Chinese social media feeds like WeChat and Weibo. This includes a lot of like translated Bannon and Fox media that like it seems like a certain number of different accounts that are, you know, are like pumping out. And there was increased images of Black violence ever since the George Floyd protests began, and increased anxiety among these sort of Chinese hometown groups that organize this protest, and fear that there will be increased, you know, Black on Asian violence, and belief that cops are necessary to protect Asians from Black violence. And so the protest was organized by 17 groups, most of which are these hometown clubs that are connected to their provinces in China, as well as a lot of real estate leaders. And so, you know, it was brought together in a second event last Friday. The first one was actually June 22nd, about a week and a half before. And again, it was many of the same people. There was the Real Estate Alliance. There were some police as well. And I think a lot of these groups felt it was necessary to express gratitude towards the police. That was their messaging, because they felt like, you know, in the midst of all these protests, they felt like, you know, there wasn't enough people on the other side also showing, you know, support for police. So I think we came together because, you know, this is a very alarming, you know, rise of the right wing, and an alarming demonstration right now when so many people are suffering, when the Black community is hit not only with COVID-19 rates higher than any other group, but also, you know, the mass incarceration and death by policing across the country for years. And so this is not a time where we want to see Asians being pitted against our Black brothers and sisters. And so we stood in solidarity in order to at least show that there are folks who are, you know, working against this, who oppose the NYPD and don't support this type of right-wing organizing in Flushing.
Lizzie, I want to turn to you now. Can you give us a sense of the character of the counter-protest, the protest that you all organized against the pro-police demonstration? And what is the name of the coalition? It's called the Alliance. Help me out.
Yes. Yeah, so, Joanna, we actually came together less than 24 hours before the protest, because we just, as soon as we found out, we decided to mainly plug in our friends, community allies. So we were seeing a lot of younger perhaps organizers who have been doing this work for a long time, right? So we were trying to connect the organizing that we've done for Asian Black solidarity with the housing organizing that people are doing, the anti-imperialist, anti-war organizing that people are doing. So it was definitely, I would say, a younger demographic, but it was also very diverse, right? We had Black allies there. We had Latino community members come out and support. So this was definitely put together last minute, but a lot of different groups came together. And we're still trying to figure out what a coalition would look like and how we can really work together going forward.
This is pretty inspiring because it's an extension of the phenomenal scenes we've seen across the country of people of color, Asians, Latinx folks, but also white Americans coming out in defense of Black lives and against anti-Black violence. And to hear that there is an effort to go into our own communities and address these issues is even more significant, because it means that you're talking to your parents, to your cousins and your grandmother, folks that we don't often talk to about politics. Can you give us a sense, either Lizzie or SX, about the demographic character of Flushing? Perhaps SX can chime in here.
Yeah, I can speak to that, but actually I think Kate might be a better person to speak to that. Flushing is historically a very historic Black community, but it is very racially diverse. I don't have the percentages in top of my head, but it is mostly non-white people. The Chinese community has been growing exponentially over the past 20 years or so, but previously, especially when my parents first immigrated in the 90s, it was a large group of Korean, Chinese, Bengali, Latino, and Black community members who made up Flushing.
And what's the class character of that community, Kate?
So a lot of Flushing is working class, and a lot of people are new immigrants in Flushing. It is, I think, 65%. I don't have the stats right on me at the moment, but I think 65% is new immigrants who have been in the community that for like less than 10 years. And so this means that, you know, the languages that are dominant in Flushing are like Mandarin, Cantonese, Korean, and, you know, increasingly the Chinese population has been growing in Flushing while other groups have been decreasing in proportion to the population.
I'm Johanna Fernandez, and I'm speaking to Lizzie O, Kate Zen, and SX Noir about the pro-police march in Flushing, Queens last week and the counter-protest these folks organized in that Pan-Asian community in support of Black lives. SX, how do you enter this conversation?
Hi.
Where are your parents from?
Thanks so much for having me. Well, rather than go that route, you know, where I come into the conversation is I am a Black woman who is being represented within this group, and I believe that to have true allyship, you have to have both sides of the parties in the conversation. And so where I came in is I am in the community as a sex work activist, specifically for Black trans lives and other Black organizers. And so Kate brought me in to the counter-protest because of my very vocal defund NYPD and very anti-police stance and abolitionist stance. I am not from New York. I'm from Missouri. I'm from the Midwest. I'm very much from Trump's America. So I absolutely understand the pro-cop agenda, the right-wing agenda, etc. So, I came in to help understand that, you know, Asians will not be used as a tool to divide us, to understand that our fight is truly transnational. The fight for anti-blackness and anti-police is truly transnational, and it involves, you know, elders and other people who are also immigrants to America as well. So, that's kind of how I've been brought in. The movement as of now that's happening in Flushing, Queens is very much Asian-led, but I think it's important to have Black people at the table when we're having these conversations as well.
So what's fascinating is that there's a anti-Asian violence at the hands of white supremacists has increased during this period. And we know that this targeting in this way of the Asian community is exploitative, because these are new immigrants. And as we know, in this country, new immigrants feel under siege, especially new immigrants of color from Asia and Latin America. So the right wing is targeting this community to continue the anti-Black racism that has existed in this country since time immemorial. And I think it's important to just underscore the issue that exists, or the conflict that exists between immigrants, not just Asian immigrants, but Latin American immigrants, and the Black community. In many ways, we have a super exploited class of immigrants, many from Latin America, who come to replace African Americans as the super exploited class in this society in the 1970s and 80s. And they come to this country. Black people are demonized, they're feeling under siege, and they want to distance themselves from that community because they feel so vulnerable and they don't want to be lumped in with the most hated and demonized. Can any of you comment on that that conflict and that relationship? Maybe Lizzie.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, anti-Asian violence definitely exists, right? Like, anti-Black racism definitely exists. And we recognize that those things are not separate, right? But that white supremacy sort of upholds both things, because it is white supremacy's interest, right, to keep Black, Latino, and Asian communities pitted against each other. And there's also this question of whether internalized racism begets sort of the society that we, the behavior and the society that we produce, or whether society is designed for us to be racist, right? And especially when we're talking about class relations, we're talking about people, working class people, who are struggling to make ends meet and are looking for, you know, people around them to blame for a lot of their conditions. And when we talk about specifically this pro-cop protest, however, we're looking at business interests. We're looking at people who may have accrued wealth in this country, or believe that they are worthy, more worthy of being protected because they own property, because they come as immigrants, and feel more vulnerable. And we want to say no. Like, the answer to anti-Asian, anti-Black violence is not more police. We want to say it's solidarity. It's us having all the resources that we all need as a community so that we can take care of each other, so that we can be truly in solidarity with each other, and so that we can protect each other. But that cops, at the end of the day, are not going to keep us safe.
Well, I'd love to chime in on that as well, if that's okay.
Yes.
I was, the counter protest was very powerful for me as a Black woman, because I felt like that couldn't have happened, for example, in a Black neighborhood. It was shocking because I guess live in a bubble because I just assumed that all minorities understood the need for, you know, no cops, you know? And so going and seeing, you know, all these Asian people, Chinese people so adamantly opposed to Black Lives Matter was shocking to me because I always thought that we understood that we were all in this together. And so it definitely made me check myself as to what our mission is as far as abolition and defunding the NYPD. You know, I learned that that blacks welcomed the Chinese into Flushing, that when Chinese immigrants were going to Flushing, that white people called the police on them the same way that white people called the police on black people. And so I was made aware of all these different transnational intersections of anti-blackness and also the influence of big tech and technology and WeChat and Facebook and WhatsApp on how this information is spread massively through our elders, through not only elders, but everyone, and how that actually, you know, we're not seeing that on the front end. It was like we saw the WeChat conversations in person for the first time, and it was insane. And it was just so much energy that was shocking to me. But I have to be aware that these conversations are happening within their community every single day, all the time. They have immediate access to it. So how do we counter that, and how do we deal with that is something that I think about all the time as a technologist.
Political education here is essential, it seems. Kate, you want to chime in here and tell us how the organizations that have come together are continuing the work of political education and historical memory, right? This notion that the black community welcomed Asians to New York.
Yeah, so our group, we work specifically with migrant sex workers in Flushing. And so our base building efforts began out of a incident of police brutality in November of 2017 when Song Yang, a massage worker, was killed during a police raid. Subsequently, we learned, you know, organizing with other people on the street where she worked and in the community, that police extortion is a rampant problem. And in fact, you know, there's already been multiple investigations on the incidences of bribery and police asking for free sexual services from sex workers. And so some of the work we have been doing in alliance with a broader coalition of orgs like BYP 100, Make the Road, Black and Latino trans-led groups in the city for the Decrim New York campaign, has been really educating our community about how police violence also impacts Asian Americans and Asian immigrants, and how a lot of Chinese immigrants in Flushing are not only, you know, preyed upon and, you know, face racial violence from white folks outside of Flushing, but also like from the police, and sex workers face a lot of stigma. People walking down the street in our own community will throw a lot of shame. And so there is a kind of class-based sort of struggle that's happening in Flushing. If you look at the real estate development groups that are trying to promote luxury development, gentrification, and also calling the cops to try to get, you know, clean up the streets, get sex workers off the streets to, you know, raise the property values. These are often not just like American kind of real estate companies, but there are transnational interests involved. These are Taiwanese companies, you know, F&T Group. And so what we see is kind of a class war that's fought on two coasts. And you have a wealthier groups of Chinese that are moving in that want to come into these luxury developments that are also, you know, pushing their way in, you know, making space and often maybe exploiting people who are of lower economic class or working class. The same goes for, I think, the struggle with street vendors. I used to be an organizer with the Street Vendor Project and saw a lot of police brutality and racial targeting and ticketing of art vendors in Times Square. One thing that happens in the Asian community, I think, is that people are afraid often of speaking up. There is a lot of, like, you know, from bicycle delivery workers to street vendors to massage workers, there's kind of a over-policing in the Asian community.
Kate, that's our bell, unfortunately. But okay. We are going to continue this conversation next week with you and others you like to invite the relationship between real estate development, the police, but also the important work of organizing sex workers. I'm Johanna Fernandez, and I've been speaking to Lizzie O, Kate Zen, and Essex Noir about the pro-police march in Flushing, Queens last week. That's the end of our show. Please tune in for a continued conversation next week on these issues. You've been listening to non-corporate, listener-funded, community-controlled radio WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. This show is produced by Jorgen Ostensen, Ajamu Sankofa, Shandani Smith, and Ellis Maxwell. Our interns are Davin Smith, Andrea Hidalgo, and Elmo Tumbacan. Michael G. Haskins is holding it down as our board operator, and I'm your host, Johanna Fernandez. Thanks for tuning in. It's a good day.
Thank you.
See you next week. Thank you so much for your incredible work.